accession number 20457, reel 34.
Brigadier Randall, reel 34. Where did your recruits do their basic training?
Well, the ones from the Earl Wet in Exeter, the Welsh ones at the Earl Welsh Brigade Depot at Kirti Gothlan, and the Earl Merton Brigade ones up at Lichfield. While I was there, I was told that we would have to lose one of the three depots, which was a very difficult thing. In the end, I decided that the one in Exeter would have to close. That didn't get me many marks with my own regiment, or the colonel of my regiment, but that was beside the point.
On what grounds did you choose Exeter?
Well, the main factor really was, funnily enough in my mind now, with the availability of rangers at Lichfield. Has got excellent rangers within a quarter of a mile of the depot. The rangers in Exeter, you have to go motor right out to a very indifferent range, Riffentour at Dartmoor. Also, there's a much better local training area at Lichfield. There was a place called Hopwish Wood. The depot in Exeter was right in the middle of Exeter. So that was the main factor. The Welsh one was a bit difficult, but the thing was that there were political aspects to that. Is the Welsh were very keen to have their own depot. And also, it was quite good training area. They were quite near Brecon Beacons and that sort of thing. Their range was a little distance away. So, but it was really on simply grounds of ranges and training areas. And I'm sure I made the right decision. And people afterwards said, well, actually, John, we objected in time, but you were quite right.
What happened then to recruits who would have gone to Exeter?
They were then split. The Devon recruits and the two Cambridge recruits went to the Welsh depot, and the Hampshires and the Gloucesters went to Lichfield. So that was.
But were there any major changes or developments in the sort of training that recruits did while you were brigadier?
I mean, the basic syllabus was laid down by the Ministry of Defence. I mean, they said how many weeks they would do, and then they said what standards had got to be achieved. There were certain amounts of blank periods. For the reason I mentioned that if it takes an hour to get to a range, well then you've got to balance the thing. There was some flexibility, but not much. I mean, it's all like education today now. I mean, everything's laid down centrally, really. I think that was really about it. It did produce problems in Wales because the Devon and Dorsets and Duke of Edinburgh were being. We had to send a proportion of sergeants and corporals and instructors to Wales. Fair enough. Same with officers. But I remember quite a little problem because I went there and I was told by, look, we've got this awful problem. A lot of sergeants want to see you and so on. I said, what's the problem? He said, it's simply this, that they've come here for 2 years. Their children are going to the local school and the Welsh insist that these children learn Welsh. And the sergeants, their mothers and said, quite said, well, we're not anti-Wales, but it's absolutely pointless that our children should just come here at varying ages and having to start to learn Welsh when they're not going to use it again. And this action became quite a political hot potato. I think common sense prevailed in the end, but you know, I mean, I had to sort of take it up and go and see the work. And of course, an English brigadier to some sort of Welsh education people. You know, I had to sort of almost open the door, throw my hat in, and then come in. But they could see. But I mean, that's the sort of situation. It arose from that sort of reorganisation.
Did you have to sort that out personally then, or did that go up through the Ministry of Defence?
I can't remember now. I know I got involved in it.
But it sounds like it's the kind of thing that might have gone up to the Welsh office in the end.
I think, yes. I mean, I meant to see these people.
Yes.
And in the end, I wasn't aggressive and said, look, I mean, this is a problem. We're not being anti-Welsh. Nothing like that at all. But these children are never going to use it again. It is spoiling the education of children by factors which are no way connected with their welfare at all. And they said, well, we do see that. At the same time, we haven't got facilities to give them something. So it did go up to higher authority in the end. It was all sorted out, but it took a bit of time. I don't know what people do nowadays. I mean, especially you're an Englishman and your company says, Ford, I want to post you to our Ford factory. You go there with your family. And then are your children exposed to learning Welsh? I mean, it's not only applied to the army, it applies to anybody, doesn't it? I don't know.
I really don't know whether you have to take Welsh or not.
I would hope nowadays that when it's during Welsh lessons, that some alternative is laid on. But I mean, it may not in a big school possible. In a small little sort of village school like Kirtycothan, they hadn't got staff resources to lay on alternative. Anyway, it's a long time ago now. But it was just an illustration of the sort of practical problems you sometimes get over redeployment of military personnel.
Perhaps a good reason for having an army school on the site.
Very good point. Yes, there wasn't one. There weren't enough children, army children, to warrant it. Mm. If there'd been a bigger garrison, I think there would have been. Yeah. That would have been an obvious answer, but there weren't enough. I think you've got to have. I don't remember the figure.
There has to be a minimum, doesn't there, to make it viable?
To make it viable. Mm. Yes, yes. Presumably, it'd been all right for primary, but I mean, we were concerned with the secondary.
Yes,
of course. Yes.
Presumably, if you had set up an army school there, the question would have arisen of whether or not you were going to offer them Welsh as an option.
Well, again, there may have been counter-arguments here. The English setting up this cell, I don't know, anyway. It was just a fascinating little problem which arose.
And the next posting, I think, was to UK Land Forces, which was really going back, wasn't it?
Going back to the same place, but of course it's a very different headquarters.
Yes. What way was it so different?
Well, before, the Army Strategic Command had simply been all the fighting troops in the UK, the two divisions plus some guns, and no administrative units other than divisional ones. UKLF, of course, was the headquarters for all troops of every nature in the United Kingdom, other than certain sort of separate places like the Staff College and things.
Yes.
And therefore, it was a much, very much more bigger headquarters. And like all big headquarters, it was perhaps lost some of its sort of esprit. Mm-hmm. But my particular appointment was entirely concerned with all the little overseas detachments all over the world. Again, it was another conception of Mike Carver's. He, at some stage, all these little units all over, and they had really, some of them did have various people responsible, but there was nobody, no one they could really look to as their sort of, to fight their battles for them, to represent them, and particularly the officers felt that from when it came to confidential reports and things, that they weren't getting a fair deal because there was nobody there who could sort of write them a report. They were just, sometimes at a critical time in their career, they were sort of lost souls. And so this post was dreamed up by Lord Carver. I was the second chap in. And so there it was. There were these posts all over the world of various sizes. And my job was to go and visit them as often as practicable.
How many detachments did you have to look after altogether?
About 20, I think. The major ones were Butters, Suffield in Western Canada, which has just been comparatively new. We've only just been going a couple of years, which I think you probably know. It was a training area for... it was a training area seven times the size of Salisbury Plain. For infantry, armoured and gunner, I mean all arms training, where we could manoeuvre and fire live firing without any dangers. It was a fairly complex place because you could only train in the summer, long distance. And you had to have a small holding unit who spent the winter, the long winter months, refurbishing the equipment had been used. That was one. Then I was also for Belize, where most of the time I was there, there was a sort of ongoing threat of Guatemalan.
Yes.
I had responsibilities in Bermuda for the Bermuda Regiment, for certain units, SIGINT units in Bahamas.
This must have represented a wide variety of types.
Yeah, well, in Africa.
And scale, too, presumably.
Well, yes, you see, then I had three NATO headquarters.
Three NATO headquarters? What, this would be after?
Well, this was just for the British personnel element.
Yes.
In Norway, in Naples, and in Izmir.
Yes.
Malta, the training teams in Kenya and the Gulf, certain responsibilities for British troops in Oman. In Mauritius, again in the Seato units in Bangkok, in Kuala Lumpur,
yes.
And then the various, the two or three training teams out at Woomera in Australia. So that was the, and they were every sort of unit, from quite big ones like Batters.
How big was Batters?
Well, Batters. In the summer months, I mean, well, you had a full colonel and something like 30 or 30 officers and warrant officers and people, and plus warrant officers and fitters and people. Then it ran down in the winter. But of course, it was a showpiece unit, you know, you couldn't afford things to go wrong there, really. There was always a major ongoing crisis because the Chieftain engine was such a bloody awful engine. There was constant crises of flying spare engines over from Germany. So, that, you know, if you've only got five or six exercises in the summer and you can't run an exercise because the tanks aren't working, you know, people start getting a bit uptight. My job was to go over and see if the place was efficiently run, to write confidential reports, and then to be their sort of backup in England if any problems. And this was the same charter for every unit, despite its size.
It sounds like it's a real rag bag, really, because you've got all sorts of...
Yes. Mm. It wasn't going to get me. I mean, I'd already been told I wasn't going to be a Major General, and I was actually given a... MS very kindly said, we have three jobs, and this was one. I said, I'll have this one, because I was virtually my own boss. Mm. I was answerable to the chief of staff. But, I mean, I decided my own program where I went. It was quite demanding because, you know, I was suffering from permanent jet lag.
Yeah.
At one stage, the Treasury said, you'll have to go economy, and I said, in that case, I'm packing it in. Wish I had packed it in now. I would have gone out in a different pension group, or I would have been £8,000 a year better off. However, that's beside the point. But in the end, they agreed. It's quite intolerable if I had to fly out to Australia and get there and get that evening, go to a reception or dinner party or something, be on the ball. And I'd been cramped up, a man of my size. In the end, they said, you can go first. So I did travel in quite comfort. But it was, you know, you went on, at one stage I was in GAN. I had responsibilities for GAN also, in the Maldives. There was a crisis. I had to go out from GAN, right on the tropics, right out to Bartos in February. So it was quite a strain in a way. But then I could set my own programmes. It was only just occasionally a fuse blew. I had to do something urgently.
What sort of problems did arise that you had to sort out?
Sorry?
What sort of problems? You said that you had to deal with any problems that came up as they arose with the overseas detachments.
Well, the one in Bartos was that the commanding officer was having an affair with one of the wives of one of his junior commanders.
And what can you do about something like that? Do you go out and sack the man or send him home or...?
Well, I went out there and I did sort it out. I had to write a report, which went to the army board. The difficulty was the personal friend of mine who'd been my principal staff officer in my previous appointment. However, it was all sorted out in the end. I didn't want to have, that's not a job I think I'd like to have to do again.
No, it sounds like it'd be very difficult to deal with something like that.
But at the end of it all, when his chap asked me, he was out of the army, and I was out, and he asked me to lunch in London, gave me back, and he said, I'd just like you to know that I don't hold anything against you. You did what you had to do, and you did it. I made a strong recommendation he didn't lose his pension. Yeah. In fact, it all blew over, and in the end, he went back to his wife. It was just a sort of, as I described it to my boss, I said, this is a sort of a male menopause.
A late
but I mean, that's an example of the sort of those sort of situations, and of course it had to be handled with Canadians. It was a joint place. It had to be handled with some tact, and I didn't want to destroy the unit's morale. So it was quite a tricky one, actually. But my experience with MS stood me in good stead.
I mean, it sounds to me as though your work here really is like that of a personnel manager.
Personnel manager would be a good term. Yes. Yeah. No, I did have yes, but then there were. That was the main function,
yes.
Personnel management.
But if you were concerned with making sure they got their confidentials, making sure they weren't forgotten because they were out on a limb somewhere, that is really personnel.
That was principally, but then there were other factors. For instance, in Bangkok, I don't know if you've been to Bangkok. Well, Bangkok traffic jam, I mean, the traffic there is awful. They had series of cars, and for various reasons, children going to school use the service transport.
Yes.
Now, if a woman with a young child gets caught in a traffic jam for 2 or 3 hours, that child could die of heat exhaustion. So, I mean, I had to battle to get air-conditioned cars. getting air conditioning out of the budget treasury. That was an example. Then there was always a battle over local overseas allowances or special allowances because of local conditions. You see, a special unit went out to do the rapier trials in Australia. It's a whole lot of technicians. I wasn't responsible for the technical aspects at all. So I took an interest in them because it made sense if I could talk to chaps a bit. But it gets out in the middle of it. You've got no experience. It's all right if you move a unit to Glasgow, but when a unit gets out in the middle of Australia, a British unit, all sorts of things crop up with which there isn't any precedent. And so one has to go out there and see them and they settle in. And certain alliances, all sorts of problems which you can't foresee. And then go back and fight with them with a British military advisor in Canberra, if necessary, or back in the MOD. So I was a personnel manager, but also the administration as well.
Did you have to deal with the Treasury direct when problems arose about allowances and that sort of thing, or were you going through the MOD financial?
Oh, I had to go through the MOD. But I mean, I got to know the system. I got to know the branch in the MOD who dealt with them, actually. And it was a question of going up and getting their trust too. I mean, if I mean they had to be convinced that, you know, that all my geese weren't swans, mm. and I wasn't, you know, I had to get that I wasn't putting up a duff case, mm. but so get their confidence at the same time, fight for my chaps if it deserves. So I had quite a whole range of things. I had to go up and see various people in the MOD to.
What sort of staff did you have to working for you for this job?
I had a second grade staff officer and mm. and two third grade staff officers. Mm. My second grade was the sort of anchor man, because mm. while I was, for instance, I was in Australia, problems could be coming in from all over the place.
So he'd be minding the shop
while
you were
out. He'd
be
minding the shop.
Yes.
And then one of the other ones did all my sort of programs and mm. air passages, because they're frightfully complicated. Yes. Yes. I can't remember what the other chap did, or he just sort of back up to the jeep. Anyway, there's just three of them. That's all. Mm.
You said that you'd been told you weren't going to become a major general. When did that happen? How much warning did they give you? That
well, I think they gave me. Just about the time I arrived in UKLF.
Right.
I just saw a letter from the military secretary's branch, the usual thing, saying that the number one selection board of themselves, so we mm. very much regret that despite your valuable services, you were not it. But I hadn't really expected to, actually. Mm. I mean, I hadn't gone through the fast stream. Mm. And I mean, I wasn't going to. The thing was, I wasn't going to get me sort of pushed around. I mean, if they really messed me about over flying, I would have...
Just gone.
I would have gone. Mm.
I mean, had you had any thoughts about what you were going to do once you left the army and got into civil
life? Yeah, I got it lined up. I was going to be regimental secretary. Mm. And I couldn't have been regimental secretary as a major general. You can't become an RO if above the rank of brigadier. And so that was another reason why I wasn't too upset. My brother was an enormously powerful wheel in commerce. I mean, mm-hmm. he could give me a job in the city, but I don't want to work for my young brother. Mm-hmm. I was perfectly happy when I took... My regiment said that they'd like me to be regimental secretary, so mm. I knew I could come down to the West Country where my friends are. Mm. So the quality of life mattered to me more than the mere sort of care. So that I was quite happy to. I wasn't bitter and twisted because I wasn't going to be a major general. Actually, I mean, I liked to be. I don't mean to pretend that, but.
Did you find, and presumably then, you didn't really find the transition to civil life much of a change if you were still
I had to move
working
out. I had to move
the
house.
Army. Yes.
Because I had a house in Oxfordshire, hmm. which fortunately they built the M40 motorway, and so it went up in value enormously. Hmm. Moved down here. I had a few months gap between, but basically no, regimental secretary was just army administration, a different sort of field. But I mean, I hadn't got to learn new tricks or anything. Mm. I just trying to think of any other aspect. Just get back to where being overseas detachments. They did find it was a very expensive thing, because my airfares alone were colossal. I mean, if you're flying first class from here to Miami, I did use RAF aircraft wherever possible. Mm. I wasn't extravagant in that sense. But then again, if you're spending two or three nights in Bermuda, your allowances it was quite an expensive post.
Yes.
And at the end of my tour, my boss was Dwyn Bramall. I'm sure you've heard of. who was a good friend of mine, he said, you know, John, I really think your job's too expensive. I think we've got to wrap it up and farm these. A lot of them were closing down, too. I mean, during the time I was doing the job, I suppose about a third to nearly just closed down. They didn't exist. I mean, we closed down the place in the Gulf. We closed down the place in the Bahamas. We closed down a lot of them. So he said, you know, I really don't think it's
a viable
thing looked at from my. And I said, well, you know, sir, I think I see your point. Mm. So my successor was given a year or 18 months to wind it all up. It doesn't exist now.
Do you have any final reflections on your career?
Except that I thoroughly enjoyed it. But then I approached it from a very different attitude. I mean, I really wanted. The three things I was perhaps looking for were adventure, travel, and comradeship. I wasn't looking to make money. Nobody stays as a soldier to make money. But certainly I got all three in good measure. As my son, who followed me, he said, of course, the trouble with you, Dad, is he said, you didn't have to look to adventure. It came to you. I thoroughly had my ups and downs. I thoroughly enjoyed my service, and I wouldn't have changed it, I don't think.